Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, March 7th, 2024. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. Protesters lined the sidewalk along Mulberry Street on Monday, waving Palestinian flags and signs condemning the city council's willingness to take an official stance against the Israel-Hamas war. More than a dozen residents from Cedar Falls and Waterloo gathered outside City Hall during the council meeting to speak against the council not moving forward with a resolution asking for a ceasefire in Gaza. The same group also protested at the Cedar Falls City Hall to denounce how that city council navigated the same issue. Activists wanted council members to publicly discuss and vote on the proposed resolution. One sign stated, "Waterloo is complicit in genocide," while another altered one of Waterloo Mayor Quentin Hart's old campaign signs to say, "No heart for democracy." Protesters chanted, "Mayor Hart, you can't hide, you're complicit in genocide." Hart read a proclamation that called for an immediate ceasefire in Israel and Gaza and affirmed the city's commitment to combat anti-Arab, anti-Semitic, and Islamophobic actions. A copy of the proclamation will be sent to state and federal representatives, as well as President Joe Biden. However, activists wanted more. They wanted the council to vote on a resolution condemning the killing of civilians and the U.S. sending funding and weapons to Israel. Had it passed, the resolution would have been sent to the state and federal governments stating the city condemns the killing of civilians in Gaza. The group didn't hear Hart's proclamation because they were standing outside the council chamber windows with megaphones, a drum, signs, and flags. As soon as people started chanting, someone in the room closed the window. One repeated chant was, "We had the vote." Protesters insisted that Hart, along with Ward 2 council member Dave Beeson, said there was enough initial support to pass the resolution. Hart said he was not familiar with these conversations. Three of seven council members previously expressed opposition to the resolution. Ward 1 council member John Chiles, at-large council member Steve Simon, and Beeson made comments stating they did not support a resolution and favored some other way of showing support to the community. Ward 3 council member Niall Wilder and Ward 4 council member Belinda Creighton Smith were supportive of the resolution. At-large council member Rob Nichols said he would support the resolution if it included condemnation of Hamas. No comments were made by Ward 5 council member Ray Foos. The council had publicly discussed the resolution since February 5th after the city's Human Rights Commission unanimously approved it in early January. Following multiple work sessions, the council prompted Hart to work with Human Rights Director Abraham Funchess to figure out what to do next. Hart said Funchess wanted to move the proclamation forward. Through a press release, the activist group said the proclamation was self-drafted by Hart. Funchess later told the Courier he worked with Hart on the proclamation and that a lot of the document's wording came from the proposed resolution drafted by the activist group. He also said the Human Rights Commission supported a proclamation. "We at least want to start with a proclamation as opposed to not doing anything at all," he said. "It just wasn't put to vote and may not have the same teeth, but it will let legislators know we're concerned." One man, Braving the Wind, said he had been protesting social justice issues for 50 years. Brian Plumley of Cedar Falls was baffled that neither city jumped on the chance to pass a resolution. Although it was not the outcome Plumley wanted, he believes the protests will show city officials that activists mean business. Nasser Zahir, who walked through the protest on his way to the council meeting, told activists he would say something at the meeting, and he did. Waterloo police are investigating after human bones were found at the city's wastewater treatment plant. A worker found an almost complete set of skeletal remains in a pond inside the facility on Easton Avenue around noon on Monday. The remains appear to have been there for a long period of time, and the identity and cause of death aren't known at this time. Police collected the bones, which will be transported to the Iowa Medical Examiner's Office in Ankeny. Officials will use dental records and DNA to try to identify the remains. Anyone with information is asked to call the Waterloo Police Detective Division at 319-291-4340, number 3, or Cedar Valley Crime Stoppers, 855-300-TIPS. The location where the remains were found is a distance from the Riverview Recreation Area where a Waterloo man disappeared in 2021. A Waterloo man has been arrested for allegedly mugging a man outside a store over the weekend. Police arrested Jesse Wayne Hinton, 29, for second-degree robbery on Monday. Bond was set at $15,000. Police said Hinton approached Brent Gray in front of Quick Stop 3, 1104 Washington Street, around 3:50 p.m. on Sunday. Hinton took items from Gray's coat pockets, and a struggle broke out when Gray attempted to retrieve the items. Gray suffered a cut to the face, and his pockets were torn in the struggle, according to police. Bus riders will have to pay more attention on their routes after major route restructuring. The Metropolitan Transit Authority is in its final stages of reworking its Waterloo routes. All that's left to do is configure what times buses arrive at stops. The new routes are expected to be implemented in the summer. Routes in Cedar Falls 6, 7, and 9 will not be changed. Depending on how the Waterloo routes are received, the company will look into the Cedar Falls ones later. Managers at Met Transit have been looking at rerouting its buses for the past 5 years, but the COVID-19 pandemic paused their progress. Once the world started to return to some sort of normal, the company picked up where it left off. The current routes are at least a 40-minute round trip. The buses go in a circle around its route, so if it takes someone 10 minutes to get to their destination, it could take another 30 for them to get back to the same location. The new routes will have both an inbound and outbound bus. The passenger that would previously have to ride the entire ride back could get on the bus to get home quicker. There will still be 7 routes, and almost all of the currently served area will continue to be served. Met took out some areas of the current route where its bus drivers rarely picked up passengers, such as Downing Avenue to Martin Road on Ainsboro Avenue, and the neighborhoods off of Dysart Road east of Hawkeye Community College. Although the same areas will be serviced, some of them may be from another bus route. Route 1 currently goes in a loop from the downtown Waterloo station, Goodwill Industries, the Social Security office, and Kimball and Ridgeway Avenues. The new Route 1 will be split into 2 routes, 1A and 1B, and stick to 4th Street. Route 1A will go to the United Medical Park and the Social Security office. Route 1B will go to the Tower Park Drive area. Route 1 will not go to Goodwill, but that area, as well as North Star and Iowa Workforce, will be picked up by the new Route 8. Route 8 will also go to Crossroads Mall. Crossroads Mall will be serviced by Routes 2, 5, and 8. With all the changes occurring, the company will not be asking the city for more money to run the new routes. However, Met Transit is proposing a new route which would require more funding. Route 12 would go from downtown Waterloo to the Waterloo Regional Airport and the surrounding businesses in the air and rail park. Operating hours and service fees are not changing. Corey Ernst, Met's fixed route operator, said they need more drivers to expand the hours from 5:45 a.m. to 6:45 p.m. The price of a ride for an adult is $1.50. Students, adults 60 years and older, people with disabilities, and Medicare card holders can pay 75 cents for a ride. Ernst said if they moved to free transit, the cities would have to pay more. Although changes may look small on the map, Sturch said the outcome could be tremendous. Our goal is to have shorter times on the buses for everybody, better transfer options, and to hopefully increase ridership, he said. Ben Barnett has been named the assistant principal at George Washington Academy, pending approval by the Waterloo Community School Board of Education. Barnett is currently an English teacher at West High School. He previously worked at Carver as an 8th grade English language arts teacher for 4 years. Barnett graduated from Central College in 2010, majoring in English, followed by Upper Iowa University in 2014, majoring in education. He is currently attending the University of Northern Iowa for a master's in principalship. He will replace Charlotte Coleman, who is retiring at the end of the school year. Waterloo firefighters rescued a cat from a burning home Tuesday morning. Neighbors called 911 around 10 a.m. after seeing smoke and flames coming from the single-story house at 1125 Downing Avenue. Firefighters said it appeared no one was home at the time, and fire crews found the cat behind a couch in the smoke-filled residence. Paramedics gave the cat supplemental oxygen, and the pet is expected to survive. The fire appears to have started in the area of the back porch and worked its way into the home and into an attic space. Firefighters extinguished the flames to keep the fire from spreading. In Evansdale, one person has been arrested for allegedly running over motorcycles parked in Evansdale during the weekend. Police arrested Ronald Lee Gilson, 61, of 4725 Millerdale Court in Waterloo, for 4 counts of second-degree criminal mischief and 1 count of reckless driving. Authorities said Gilson was behind the wheel of a Chevrolet Blazer equipped with a snowplow blade when he struck the motorcycles in the 3500 block of Lafayette Road around 4:37 p.m. on Saturday. The motorcycles belonged to 2 people from Fort Dodge, a person from Waterloo, and a person from Cedar Rapids. Police went to Gilson's home shortly after the incident and found his truck parked with a warm engine and transfer paint from the motorcycles, according to court records. A Waterloo man accused of fatally assaulting a 72-year-old man outside a grocery store in 2022 may argue he acted in self-defense or defense of others. Attorneys for Lutrill Dwayne Allen, 50, filed a notice he may claim justification in the death of Ibrahim Lagumsik when the matter goes to trial. Allen is charged with second-degree murder, and prosecutors have charged him as a habitual offender, which means he could face sentencing enhancements because of prior felony convictions. Allen's wife had earlier problems with Lagumsik. In 2020, Lagumsik allegedly struck her with his walking stick during an argument at the Hometown Foods on East Mitchell Avenue, according to courtroom testimony. Then, on March 7, 2022, the wife and Legumzik encountered each other again as they both exited the store. Legumzik headed to his vehicle, and Allen's wife went to her vehicle where Allen was waiting. Allen then exited the vehicle and walked toward Legumzik. Police allege Allen punched Legumzik, who collapsed in the parking lot and threw up blood. Allen and his wife left the area. Legumzik remained hospitalized for months, and on August 27, 2022, he died of hip complications from head trauma. Disagreement, disconnect, and distrust were on display Monday at City Hall over whether the City Council should formally call for a ceasefire between Hamas and Israel in Gaza. It was the third straight meeting where a significant amount of time was devoted to the issue. The public comment portion of the meeting fueled chaos after Mayor Danny Laudick presided over a committee update on the subject and later offered a statement after the council again declined to act. The decision was in response to pressure from a large group that had requested a resolution be adopted. People in the group want the council to acknowledge a belief that the United States is funding genocide by supporting Israel. Close to 20 people spoke on the issue, which was more than the previous two meetings. They gathered outside City Hall on a chilly night during the meeting with signs and Palestinian flags. They had hoped the resolution would be given the same amount of time as issues such as trash collection were given during a committee meeting before the eruption of comments at the council meeting. Human Rights Commission chairperson Sonia Bach, who applauded the Waterloo City Council for its work sessions and level of civic engagement on the issue, called out frustrations she had with Laudick. Some stemmed from an email the mayor sent commissioners expressing his understanding of the conversations he'd had with Bach on the topic, according to Laudick. Bach and others called on the city's elected officials to represent all people, including the majority of residents who didn't vote in the last election. She also referenced a collaboration the mayor supposedly failed to initiate between council members and the commission, despite spending hours trying to address what he's called important concerns around the issue. "It was a collaboration that didn't exist," she contended afterwards. The Human Rights Commission previously endorsed a resolution in support of a ceasefire. Many of those who spoke at the council meeting pushed for at least a work session and vote on such a measure. Some also responded to a remark made by Gil Schultz, one of the two council members who spoke publicly on the issue Monday. Schultz referenced residents he'd heard from who said they were scared to attend the city proceedings because of the protests. Bach deflected the comment, saying, "They're not violent people." Several others took offense. Monday marked the first time that other residents disagreed during public comment with the protest group's rationale. Laudick reaffirmed a previous misunderstanding. The council did not see a resolution on an international issue as appropriate action in unanimously representing the city of 41,000. The mayor again denounced hate speech, bigotry, and Islamophobia, and noted that anyone who makes people feel unsafe as they criticize government will not be tolerated. He expressed support for the Human Rights Commission as well. He again left the door open to exploring other options to address concerns through educational events or support services. Brian Heath is hoping the city can return to a pay-as-you-throw automated system. The City Council was unanimous Monday in authorizing its legal department to draft a proposed ordinance at the request of the longtime operations and maintenance division manager. It would add a $15 charge when residents overfill their trash can or necessitate a truck revisiting their home after missing the pickup time. Council member Anna Crisman was absent. Currently, there is no penalty. In communities with these PAYT programs, however, residents are supposed to be charged based on the amount they throw away, Heath told the council in committee. At least 20 offenses are recorded on average per week of the tens of thousands in Cedar Falls who take advantage of the PAYT automated collection, a program offered since 1994. The fee will help barely cover the cost of the additional trash and the time taken to return to collect it, as well as deter repeat offenders, said Heath. The hope is ultimately reduces the amount of waste headed to the landfill and encourages people to reconsider recycling and make pre-consumer choices. The charge is on top of the additional monthly rate between $9.46 and $27.84 based on the size of one's receptacle. The city is considering the fee now because of the advanced technological capabilities with its trucks. They can assess whether or not trash can lids are open more than 45 degrees and if receptacles go unemptied. We now have the software that's able to collect photo evidence, said Heath. For comparison, Heath said Waterloo and Waverly charges $20 and $25, respectively, for similar violations. Cedar Rapids' fee is $11. Council member Darrell Cruz, who owns rental properties, expressed concern about landlords accepting the liability of their tenants. He initiated about a half hour of additional discussion and motioned that a warning letter precede any fines being levied. Cruz's proposal met resistance, failed to gain any support, and died. That pushback was evident during a tense exchange with Councilmember Gil Schultz, also a landlord. Councilmember Dustin Ganfield advised City Attorney Kevin Rogers to include a grace period for landlords in the ordinance's language or rollout so they can update lease agreements to reflect the new fees. Right now, assessments are made on overflowing receptacles and late pickup, but the customers are merely notified and no repercussions are taken, according to Heath. We don't want that mess to get out of hand, so we will pick it up and tag the cart and indicate it was overfilled, he told the council. Customers have been able to pick up a special tag from Hy-Vee or the transfer station for an extra garbage bag needing to be picked up in addition to a full receptacle. They're charged minimally, or they can bring the extra or missed trash to the centrally located transfer station on their own. The ordinance would amend Chapter 10. It needs to be approved on three readings. The first consideration could be as soon as March 18th. Approximately $200,000 in state grants may soon become available to the benefit of those needing more affordable, accessible, and safer housing in the city, according to the Iowa Northland Regional Council of Governments. On Monday, the City Council voted 6-0 in favor of a contract paying as much as $2,620 to Beecher, Field, Walker, Morris, Hoffman, and Johnson. The Waterloo firm will help in establishing the nonprofit known as a local housing trust that is needed to unlock the funding. Cedar Falls is looking to change its status as one of the few communities and possibly the only community where local agencies cannot access the State Housing Trust Fund. The council did not discuss the item at the meeting. Council member Hannah Chrisman was absent. INRCOG will be in charge of applying to certify the trust through the Iowa Finance Authority and would continue to provide personnel in support of the trust. Cedar Falls is among INRCOG's local government members in its 6-county area. The Iowa Northland Regional Housing Trust Fund is already established to serve a region including Black Hawk County, but excludes Waterloo and Cedar Falls. Waterloo already has the Waterloo Housing Trust Fund. The Council will be asked this summer to approve a resolution of support for the application, according to Brian Schoen, INRCOG Executive Director. Later, it needs to adopt a resolution acknowledging local match funding necessary for the certification each year. First, though, Beecher Field, Walker Morris, Hoffman & Johnson will assist a working group with the articles and bylaws needed to obtain the 501c3 nonprofit status. Currently, Schoen said the group will be putting together a necessary plan outlining a menu of projects for which those funds may be expended upon. The trust will have its own board, but may have city representatives and people from the working group on it. That group is a half dozen people ranging from municipal officials and retired folks to nonprofit and economic development professionals, said Schoen. Once the certification is in hand, hopefully by the fall, local agencies would be able to apply for funding in response to a request for a proposal for the first set of awards given out January 1, 2025. The agencies distribute the dollars to income-qualifying clients who need assistance with expenses such as paying emergency rent, repairing or rehabilitating their home, making a living situation more accessible, or covering the buy-down while closing on a home purchase. At the Monday meeting, the council also approved a development procedures agreement outlining expectations for Panther Farms, a Brent Dahlstrom company, for proposed new housing on the 54.79 acres of open land north of Bess Streeter Aldrich Elementary School and south of Greenhill Road. Plans for the annual street restoration project. This year, the work would touch portions of six streets over 1.54 miles for an estimated $1.56 million, according to engineer Ben Claypool. The roads include Linden Avenue from Delta Drive to Hudson Road, Laurel Circle from Hudson Road to Clark Drive, Nordic Drive from a dead end to 500 feet past Westminster Drive, Grand Boulevard from Timber Drive to River Falls Hills School Drive, Lone Tree Road from Ford Road to Hiawatha Road, and Greenhill Road from Hudson Road to Ashworth Drive. A referral from Councilman Darrell Cruz in a 4-2 vote for future committee discussion on changing the council's regular meeting date to the first and third Tuesdays of every month. Right now they're on Mondays. The exception is holidays. Council members Kelly Dunn and Gil Schultz opposed. A referral from Schultz to place on the March 18th agenda on the first of three readings an ordinance changing the speed limit on Center Street between Lone Tree Road and Clare Street to a continuous 25 miles per hour. Some legs of the corridor are 35, while others are 25. No traffic study has been completed on the corridor as is currently laid out. The North Cedar Neighborhood Association had discussed and supported the change, according to Schultz. A March 18th hearing date for conveying approximately 7.57 acres to Blackhawk Properties, LLC, for a planned 78,000-square-foot building in the city's industrial park along Innovation Drive and south of the Amazon distribution facility under construction. And nearing the finish line is the passing of an ordinance allowing for traffic speed cameras in Waverly. Out of the gate, the focus would be 4th Street Southwest, and fines would start at $75 when traveling at least 10 miles per hour over the posted limits. The City Council passed the measure on the second of three readings in a 5-2 vote. Council members Tim Kangas and Rodney Drenko dissented. The last reading is slated for March 18th, and a contract for a camera vendor is also expected to be up for approval at that time. An automated traffic enforcement system of cameras and sensors would capture images of vehicles speeding, but also running red lights and not yielding to pedestrians when they have the right-of-way. Stop sign and pedestrian violations would be tagged with $100 fines. Speed violations would start at 11 to 20 miles per hour above the limit at $75, 21 to 25 miles per hour at $100, and 26 to 30 at $150, and more than 31 at $200. What the police department emphasizes are less than those in the state code enforced by officers. Construction zones automatically double the fine. The 4th Street corridor would be the focus, but all high-risk and high-cash crash areas may be candidates for areas enforced by the technology. Police Chief Richard Purcell notes as part of a lengthy memo that Waverly is considering what's known as ATE for several reasons, including a commitment to safety and lowering risk, the frequency of citizens' traffic complaints, a desire to attain voluntary compliance, the higher efficiency and effectiveness of technology compared to officers, a desire to reduce the need for officers in dangerous areas of the roadway, a desire for higher consistency enforcement and eliminating the perception of officer discrimination during traffic stops. Civil fines would be the penalties captured by the technology and will be reviewed by a police officer, but in no event will a violation be noted on one's driving record. In other words, they're not treated the same as a typical traffic or speeding ticket. Drivers will be mailed the citation and given directions on how to pay it. Within 30 days of the date of the notice, a person may appeal on a form made available by the city. A recipient who fails to pay the fine or challenge the ticket may be issued a municipal infraction. The cameras had been a serious possibility at least since the summer when study results, compiled with the help of Genoptic Smart Mobility Solutions, were presented and discussed. Council gave the go-ahead in August to explore further the possibility of implementing the technology. The first reading came February 19th, during the same meeting as the controversial budget decisions were made that advanced the possibility of closing the outdoor pool for the summer, making significant cuts to the library's operating dollars and laying off the engineering and vegetation management departments. Administrator James Bronner previously emphasized that any camera revenue was separated from the proposed budget and no aspect is reliant upon any revenues generated because of not being able to depend on them. Police, fire, ambulance was always my intent, added Bronner, about which funds they'd likely support with any revenues. You're listening to The Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, March 7th, 2024 on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And in more Waverly Shellrock news, construction work continues moving forward at Prairie West and Shellrock Elementary Schools. Ryan Nelson of Estes Construction told the Board of Education Monday that continuing finishing to drywall and painting will be completed before work is done on the kitchen and other interior items. Work on Prairie West is about 2 months from completion. Davenport-based Estes is the construction manager for the Waverly Shellrock Community Schools building and renovation projects, as well as for the North Ridge Elementary School construction, which has been completed. With the continued renovation of Shellrock Elementary, Nelson noted that drywall hanging and finishing is done throughout the space, as well as painting. Workers have begun roughing in above ceiling installation for such needs as electrical, wire, and plumbing. Move-in for the Shellrock location is set to start in July. Shellrock students are currently attending classes at North Ridge. The two new Waverly buildings will replace Margaretta Carey Southeast and West Cedar Elementary Schools. During Monday's meeting, the board set a 5 p.m. March 19th public hearing for the sale of Carey following initial approval in February. The hearing will be held in advance of an already scheduled board work session at the district's Central Administration Building, 1415 4th Avenue Southwest. The school, located at 220 9th Avenue Northwest, would be sold for $40,000 to Bartles Lutheran Retirement Community, which plans to expand its housing for seniors. Last month, the board approved the sale of West Cedar to the Waverly Municipal Housing Commission. The school district plans to keep the Southeast building. In Black Hawk County news, a bicyclist was airlifted to the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City on Tuesday after being struck by a vehicle in Buchanan County near Fairbank. At 2:10 p.m., the Buchanan County Sheriff's Office responded to a vehicle versus bicyclist accident in the 300 block of Fairbank Amish Boulevard, which is southeast of Fairbank. Richie Kurtenbach is seeking a seat on the Black Hawk County Board of Supervisors. Kurtenbach, a Waterloo resident, has lived in the area since 1991. He was a key figure in the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local Union 288 as a business manager and market development coordinator. He has been an IBEW member for 44 years and a labor leader for 27 years. Kurtenbach listed three issues he would focus on. He wants to keep the community safe through 911 services and supporting public safety, connect residents with resources through county departments, and work with local government on behalf of the county. His campaign slogan is, "In a world full of problems, be part of the solution." And on to today's obituaries. Betty Diane Youngblood, 68 years old, of Jessup, died Wednesday, February 21st. No services are planned at this time. Diane was born May 3, 1955. She and her husband, Jim, met in 1978 and have been together 46 years. Diane worked as a sales clerk at Walmart and for several years and had also worked at Triangle Plastics in Independence. Raymond Ray Clarence Distler. Raymond, 78, of Raymond, Iowa, died at Ascension St. John Hospital in Tulsa, Oklahoma, on February 27th. Public visitation for Raymond will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. on Friday, March 8th, at Haggerty Wyckoff Grarup Funeral Service South Street location, where there will be a 4 p.m. rosary. Funeral Mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, March 9th, at Queen of Peace Catholic Church. Public visitation will be held 1 hour prior to the services. Immediately following Mass, Raymond will be laid to rest at Mount Olivet Cemetery. Memorial contributions may be directed in Raymond's name to his family. Delbert Carolus, 78, of Parkersburg, died Saturday, March 2nd, in Waterloo. He was born December 16, 1945, in Clarion. He graduated from Garner Hayfield High School in 1963 and attended junior college. He served honorably in the U.S. Army during the Vietnam War. Following his military service, Delbert worked for Schwann's Ice Cream for 30 years. No services are planned at this time. In lieu of flowers, the family kindly requests that donations be made in Delbert's name to Cedar Falls AmVets Post 49 or Cedar Valley Hospice. Velva Mardine Destival was born on February 20th, 1924. She eloped and married Ora Butts on February 14th, 1942. Ora passed away in August of 1980. Velva then married Robert Destival on August 13, 1983. Velva was employed in several financial institutions in Des Moines and Waterloo, retiring from GMAC Mortgage. A private family burial will take place at a later date. George Hahn, age 90, died Monday, March 4th at Virginia Gay Nursing and Rehab in Vinton. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 9th at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Vinton. Burial will follow at Evergreen Cemetery in Vinton. A visitation will be held from 9 until 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 9th at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Vinton. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to St. Mary's Catholic Church. George was the seventh of 12 children, born on January 21, 1934, in Grand Mound. He was a 1952 graduate of St. Joseph's High School in DeWitt and served in the Army in Korea from 1954 to 1956. George was united in marriage to Joan Steger on October 4, 1958. He worked as a hog buyer for 42 years. George and Joan moved to Vinton in 1978 and later purchased a small farm south of town where they built their home. He was a member of St. Mary's Catholic Church and the Daybreaker Kiwanis Club. George enjoyed going to farm machinery auctions and spending time in his shop restoring old tractors. Robert David Fulton died peacefully of natural causes on February 21st. Bob was born in Waterloo. He attended East High School, UNI, and earned a law degree from the University of Iowa in 1958. Bob met Rachel Brio of Chicopee Falls, Massachusetts, at a USO event while serving at Westover Air Force Base. They were married in 1955. He was a founding member of a successful law firm in Waterloo and also pursued a career in politics as a Democrat. He was elected to the Iowa House in 1958, the Senate in 1962, and was elected Lieutenant Governor in 1964 and 1966. While his run for governor in 1970 was unsuccessful, he did have the privilege and distinction to serve as the 37th Governor of Iowa, even if it for only 2 weeks, January 1st through 14th, 1969. The family requests, in lieu of flowers, donations be made to either KHKE 89.5, which is Iowa Public Radio, or KSJN 99.5, your classical radio. A private internment service will be held at a later date. And in local sports news, Mook Zimmerman walked into the Get Air Trampoline Park to claps and handshakes on Thursday. The new head coach of the Iowa Woo was confident. That was clear in front of the fans and stakeholders of Waterloo's new indoor professional football team during his introductory event. And why not? Team advisor Tommy Benazio described the man as dedicated, determined, stylish, and uniquely handsome, as he was introduced in his suit with shades and a well-tamed beard. Those adjectives were a few reasons for holding his head high, but more important than all that is the fact that the Waterbury, Connecticut native and Sacred Heart University product, otherwise known as Hollywood, has lived for winning wherever he's gone, owning a 42 record as a head coach. Zimmerman was a 5-year pro arena football player in the United States and spent 2 years playing pro football in Europe and Brazil. He's a former head coach with the Buffalo Lightning and Richmond Rough Riders, and most recently was a defensive line linebackers coach for the Massachusetts Pirates. All professional indoor or arena football teams he spent time with the last decade or so. Besides the high expectations, he was ecstatic to not just lead another football team, but become the first ever head coach of Waterloo's new squad that's guaranteed 3 seasons in the Arena League, a new 6-on-6 indoor American Football League. The team will debut at 7:05 p.m. May 25th at the Hippodrome, 257 Ainsborough Avenue, against an opponent not yet determined. Owners Jeff Holmes and Julia Stone hired him for his character, zest, coaching accolades, winning record, and championships. Ownership also confirmed Thursday it has recently parted ways with Bailey McCray, the Waterloo East alumnus who'd been the inaugural general manager since last summer. Right now, the plan is to absorb her duties and not fill the position. The franchise had undergone another notable change when it rebranded from the Waterloo Woo to the Iowa Woo upon Holmes and Stone taking the helm in October. One of Zimmerman's assistant coaches is Frank Costin. Most recently, he was an assistant coach working with receivers on the Sprint football team at Army West Point. Costin's been there with Zimmerman every step of his coaching journey. He pointed out during his introduction before explaining how his style of treating everyone like family is how he achieved his greatness. And in boys' high school basketball, Nate Stege simply called it the craziest game he's ever coached. In a game that neither team could create any type of separation from the other, Stege's Waverly Shell Rock Gohawks found a way Tuesday. Noah Frazel made a free throw with 1.8 seconds left in overtime, and Pella's Jack McGuire's three-point heave at the buzzer glanced off the front rim as Waverly Shell Rock pulled out a 65-64 victory over the Dutch in a Class 3A state quarterfinal at Wells Fargo Arena. The teams continually traded the lead, and nobody led by more than 4 over the final 22 minutes of the game. The victory advances Waverly Shell Rock to a 3:45 p.m. semifinal against MOC Floyd Valley on Thursday. The Gohawks committed 6 turnovers in the opening 11 minutes that led to 11 Dutch points. Tuesday's game was Waverly Shell Rock's first state appearance since 2018. Camden Davis did not miss the charity toss this time. A year ago, with a chance to send Hudson to the state tournament in a sub-state final, Davis missed from the three-throw line. The senior center made 4 free throws with under 25 seconds to go, and Tanner Michael sealed it with 2 more with 3 seconds left as the Pirates pulled out a 55-51 Class 2A state quarterfinal victory over Grundy Center Tuesday at Wells Fargo Arena. In a tremendous game between two teams that were appearing in their first state tournaments in decades, Grundy Center, that appeared in 2003, and Hudson in 1993, neither team refused to give the other an inch. Grundy Center led for more than 20 minutes of the game, but the largest lead it ever held was 6, and the largest lead the Pirates had was the final margin. The difference was a tenacious defensive effort by Hudson in the closing minutes as the Spartans desperately attempted to pull out the victory over the second-seeded Pirates. Grundy Center finished with 18 turnovers. The Spartans, who started 4 juniors, were led by Jalen Kirkpatrick with 18 points and 9 rebounds. Michael led Hudson with 21 points, while Davis had 16 points, 12 rebounds, and 3 blocks to help the Pirates find their way to a Thursday 12:15 p.m. tilt with Unity Christian, who topped third-seeded Underwood, 59-55. The two teams had met back on December 1st with a 66-55 Hudson victory. And 7th-seeded Gladbrook Rhinebeck scored just 6 points over the final 11 minutes and 33 seconds as Marquette Catholic rallied past the Rebels 45-36 Monday in a Class 1A boys state basketball opener at Wells Fargo Arena. Gladbrook Rhinebeck, which was making its second consecutive state tournament trip and fifth overall since winning the 1A title in 2015, led for most of the game. Clark led Gladbrook Rhinebeck with 11 points, 2 steals, and 2 assists. Eilers had 7 points, 15 rebounds, and 3 assists. The Rebels graduate just one starter, Clark, and 2 other seniors, Austin Gehring and Austin Vavarica, but return more than 65% of their scoring, including Michael Boyd's 14.2 points and 7.3 rebounds per game. And that does it for today's sports. The Hawkeye Community College audit gets a favorable rating. They got it from Bergen KDV of Minneapolis in its fiscal year 2023 audit. Ryan Engelstad recently presented the audit to the Board of Trustees for the year that ended June 30th and gave the college kudos for staying so close to its budget. Hawkeye had $70.63 million in revenues and $70.41 million in expenditures. Capital assets grew by $8.94 million from $73.15 million in 2022 to $82.08 million in 2023, a gift from the Hawkeye Foundation to assist with campus capital projects accounted for $4.56 million of the increase, as new projects start in the current fiscal year, like the renovation of the First Impressions Courtyard and Regional Transportation Training Center. The amount of capital assets is expected to rise. Hawkeye did see a drop of $5.44 million in its unrestricted fund balance to $8.83 million during the fiscal year. The fund balance, also known as cash reserves, represents money available for emergencies and is often considered a measure of financial stability. In fiscal year 2023, operating expenses grew 4.27 million dollars. There were fluctuations in revenue due to a number of factors. Tuition and fees dropped $1.78 million. Federal appropriations, including Pell Grants, decreased $4.03 million as pandemic relief ended in 2022. In other instances, funding grew and more revenue was generated. State appropriations increased $1.31 million and the Industrial New Jobs Training Program increased by $712,000. Interest on investments increased $2.37 million due to a rise in interest rates. Another positive coming in the audit, according to Engelstad, is the decrease in long-term debt. As of June 30th, Hawkeye Community College had $24.79 million in outstanding debt. That is a $3.28 million decrease from 2022, when the debt owed was $28.06 million. Hawkeye continues to take steps in anticipation of enrollment decreases experienced by most of Iowa's community colleges due to demographic and economic fluctuations. Cost-cutting measures in the past few years have helped mitigate the loss of tuition revenue. Hawkeye and other educational entities are required to be audited by a third party each year to ensure they fairly state their financial position. Auditors did not identify any significant deficiencies or material weaknesses over financial reporting or major programs, and there were no instances of noncompliance. And we end with something for your sweet tooth. Students from St. John Catholic School in Independence found their sweet spot Wednesday at Hartman Reserve Nature Center. About a dozen sixth graders spent several hours learning how syrup is made in Hartman's Sugar Shack with Blackhawk County conservation naturalist Katie Kloos. We have a lot of field trips through Hartman involving the tapping of trees and making maple syrup at this time of year. I feel like an old timer. I've been doing maple syruping for 14 years, and it's still fun, she said. The 38th annual Maple Syrup Festival is Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the center. The annual community event is a reservations-only fundraiser for Black Hawk County Conservation. Attendees can watch volunteers, cooks, flipping pancakes, and enjoy all-you-can-eat pancakes with pure maple syrup made from the sap of Hartman's maple trees. Sausage, sidecar coffee, and Hansen's dairy products will round out the menu. Tickets are $10 for adults, $5 for youth ages 3 to 15, and free for children 2 and under. Tickets must be purchased through the website blackhawkcountyparks.com. No paper tickets will be sold in advance or at the door. No walk-ins will be accepted. Proceeds from the fundraiser will benefit environmental education, recreational programs, and natural resource management of county parks. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Thursday, March 7th. I'm your reader, Grace Barter. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.